about ourselves. We know what we are really like inside, so we can easily find ways to explain away our selfish acts and cling to the illusion that we are better than others. Ambiguity abets the illusion. For many traits, such as leadership, there are so many ways to define it that one is free to pick the criterion that will most flatter oneself. If I'm confident, I can define leadership as confidence. If I think I'm high on people's skills, I can define leadership as the ability to understand and influence people. When comparing ourselves to others, the general process is this. Frame the question unconsciously, automatically, so that the trait in question is related to a self-perceived strength. Then go out and look for evidence that you have the strength. Once you find a piece of evidence, once you have a make-sense story, you are done. You can stop thinking and revel in your self-esteem. It's no wonder, then, that in a study of 1 million American high school students, 70% thought they were above average on leadership ability, but only 2% thought they were below average. Everyone can find some skill that might be construed as related to leadership, and then find some piece of evidence that one has that skill. College professors are less wise than high school students in this respect. 94% of us think we do above average work. But when there is little room for ambiguity, how tall are you? How good are you at juggling? People tend to be much more modest. If the only effect of these rampant esteem-inflating biases was to make people feel good about themselves, they would not be a problem. In fact, evidence shows that people who hold pervasive positive illusions about themselves, their abilities, and their future prospects are mentally healthier, happier, and better liked than people who lack such illusions. But such biases can make people feel that they deserve more than they do, thereby setting the stage for endless disputes with other people who feel equally over-entitled. I fought endlessly with my first-year college roommates. I had provided much of our furniture, including the highly valued refrigerator, and I did most of the work keeping our common space clean. After a while, I got tired of doing more than my share. I stopped working so hard and let the space become messy so that someone else would pick up the slack. Nobody did. But they did pick up my resentment, and it united them in their dislike of me. The next year, when we no longer lived together, we became close friends. When my father drove me and my refrigerator up to college that first year, he told me that the most important things I was going to learn, I would not learn in the classroom, and he was right. It took many more years of living with roommates, but I finally realized what a fool I had made of myself that first year. Of course, I thought I did more than my share. Although I was aware of every little thing I did for the group, I was aware of only a portion of everyone else's contributions. And even if I had been correct in my accounting, I was self-righteous in setting up the accounting categories. I picked the things I cared about, such as keeping the refrigerator clean, and then gave myself an A+ in that category. As with other kinds of social comparison, ambiguity allows us to set up the comparison in ways that favor ourselves, and then to seek evidence that shows we are excellent cooperators. Studies of such unconscious overclaiming show that when husbands and wives estimate the percentage of housework each does, their estimates total more than 120%. When MBA students in a work group make estimates of their contributions to the team, the estimates total 139%. Whenever people form cooperative groups, which are usually of mutual benefit, self-serving biases threaten to fill group members with mutual resentment. I'm right, you're biased. If spouses, colleagues, and roommates so easily descend into resentment, things get worse when people who lack affection or shared goals have to negotiate. Vast societal resources are expended on litigation, labor strikes, divorce disputes, and violence after failed peace talks because the same self-serving biases are at work fomenting hypocritical indignation. In these high-pressure situations, the lawyers, real and metaphorical, are working round the clock to spin and distort the case in their client's favor. George Lowenstein and his colleagues at Carnegie Mellon found a way to study the process by giving pairs of research subjects a real legal case to read about a motorcycle accident in Texas, assigning one subject to play the defendant and one the plaintiff, and then giving them real money to negotiate with. Each pair was told to reach a fair agreement and warned that, if they failed to agree, a settlement would be imposed and court costs deducted from the pool of money, leaving both players worse off. When both players knew which role each was to play from the start, each read the case materials differently, made different guesses about what settlement the judge in the real case had imposed, and argued in a biased way. More than a quarter of all pairs failed to reach an agreement. However, when the players didn't know which role they were to play until after they had read all the materials, they became much more reasonable, and only 6% of pairs failed to settle. Recognizing that hiding negotiators' identities from them until the last minute is not an option in the real world, Lowenstein set out to find other ways to debias negotiators. He tried having subjects read a short essay about the kinds of self-serving biases that affect people in their situation to see whether subjects could correct for the biases. No dice. Although the subjects used the information to predict their opponent's behavior more accurately, they did not change their own biases at all. As Epley and Dunning had found, people really are open to information that will predict the behavior of others, but they refuse to adjust their self-assessments. In another study, Lowenstein followed the advice often given by marriage therapists to have each subject first write an essay arguing the other person's case as convincingly as possible, even worse than no dice. The manipulation backfired, perhaps because thinking about your opponent's arguments automatically triggers additional thinking on your own part as you prepare to refute them. One manipulation did work. When subjects read the essay about self-serving biases and were then asked to write an essay about weaknesses in their own case, their previous righteousness was shaken. Subjects in this study were just as fair-minded as those who learned their identities at the last minute. But before you get too optimistic about this technique for reducing hypocrisy, you should realize that Lowenstein was asking subjects to find weaknesses in their cases, in the positions they were arguing for, not in their characters. When you try to persuade people to look at their own personal picture of Dorian Gray, they put up a much bigger fight. Emily Pronin at Princeton and Lee Ross at Stanford have tried to help people overcome their self-serving biases by teaching them about biases and then asking, okay, now that you know about these biases, do you want to change what you just said about yourself? Across many studies, the results were the same. People were quite happy to learn about the various forms of self-serving bias and then apply their newfound knowledge to predict others' responses. But their self-ratings were unaffected. Even when you grab people by the lapels, shake them and say, "Listen to me, most people have an inflated view of themselves, be realistic," they refuse, muttering to themselves, "Well, other people may be biased, but I really am above average on leadership." Cronin and Ross trace this resistance to a phenomenon they call naive realism. Each of us thinks we see the world directly as it really is. We further believe that the facts as we see them are there for all to see. Therefore, others should agree with us. If they don't agree, it follows either that they have not yet been exposed to the relevant facts, or else that they are blinded by their interests and ideologies. People acknowledge that their own backgrounds have shaped their views, but such experiences are invariably seen as deepening one's insights. For example, being a doctor gives a person special insight into the problems of the healthcare industry, but the background of other people is used to explain their biases and covert motivations. For example, doctors think that lawyers disagree with them about tort reform not because they work with the victims of malpractice and therefore have their own special insights, but because their self-interest biases their thinking. It just seems plain as day to the naive realist that everyone is influenced by ideology and self-interest. Except for me. I see things as they are. If I could nominate one candidate for biggest obstacle to world peace and social harmony, it would be naive realism, because it is so easily ratcheted up from the individual to the group level. My group is right because we see things as they are. Those who disagree are obviously biased by their religion, their ideology, or their self-interest. Naive realism gives us a world full of good and evil. And this brings us to the most disturbing implication of the sage's advice about hypocrisy. Good and evil do not exist outside of our beliefs about them. Satan satisfies. One day in 1998, I received a handwritten letter from a woman in my town whom I did not know. The woman wrote about how crime, drugs, and teen pregnancy were all spiraling out of control. Society was going downhill as Satan spread his wings. The woman invited me to come to her church and find spiritual shelter. As I read her letter, I had to agree with her that Satan had spread his wings, but only to fly away and leave us in peace. The late 1990s was a golden age. The Cold War was over. Democracy and human rights were spreading. South Africa had vanquished apartheid. Israelis and Palestinians were reaping the fruits of the Oslo Accords, and there were encouraging signs from North Korea. Here in the United States, crime and unemployment had plummeted. The stock market was climbing ever higher, and the ensuing prosperity was promising to erase the national debt. Even cockroaches were disappearing from our cities because of widespread use of the roach poison Combat. So what on earth was she talking about? When the moral history of the 1990s is written, it might be titled Desperately Seeking Satan. With peace and harmony ascendant, Americans seemed to be searching for substitute villains. We tried drug dealers, but then the crack epidemic waned, and child abductors, who are usually one of the parents. The cultural right vilified homosexuals. The left vilified racists and homophobes. As I thought about these various villains, including the older villains of communism and Satan himself, I realized that most of them share three properties. They are invisible. You can't identify the evil one from appearance alone. Their evil spreads by contagion, making it vital to protect impressionable young people from infection, for example, from communist ideas, homosexual teachers, or stereotypes on television. And the villains can be defeated only if we all pull together as a team. It became clear to me that people want to believe they are on a mission from God, or that they are fighting for some more secular good, animals, fetuses, women's rights, and you can't have much of a mission without good allies and a good enemy. The problem of evil has bedeviled many religions since their birth. If God is all good and all powerful, either he allows evil to flourish, which means he is not all good, or else he struggles against evil, which means he is not all powerful. Religions have generally chosen one of three resolutions of this paradox. One solution is straight dualism. There exists a good force and an evil force. They are equal and opposite, and they fight eternally. Human beings are part of the battleground. We were created part good, part evil, and we must choose which side we will be on. This view is clearest in religions emanating from Persia and Babylonia, such as Zoroastrianism, and the view influenced Christianity as a long-lived doctrine called Manichaeism. A second resolution is straight monism. There is one God. He created the world as it needs to be, and evil is an illusion. A view that dominated religions that developed in India. These religions hold that the entire world, or at least its emotional grip upon us, is an illusion, and that enlightenment consists of breaking out of the illusion. The third approach, taken by Christianity, blends monism and dualism in a way that ultimately reconciles the goodness and power of God with the existence of Satan. This argument is so complicated that I cannot understand it. Nor, apparently, can many Christians who, judging by what I hear on gospel radio stations in Virginia, seem to hold a straight Manichaean worldview, according to which God and Satan are fighting an eternal war. In fact, despite the diversity of theological arguments made in different religions, concrete representations of Satan, demons, and other evil entities are surprisingly similar across continents and eras. From a psychological perspective, Manichaeism makes perfect sense. Our life is the creation of our mind, as Buddha said, and our minds evolved to play Machiavellian tit-for-tat. We all commit selfish and short-sighted acts, but our inner lawyer ensures that we do not blame ourselves or our allies for them. We are thus convinced of our own virtue, but quick to see bias, greed, and duplicity in others. We are often correct about others' motives, but as any conflict escalates, we begin to exaggerate grossly, to weave a story in which pure virtue, our side, is in a battle with pure vice, theirs. The Myth of Pure Evil. In the days after receiving that letter, I thought a lot about the need for evil. I decided to write an article on this need and use the tools of modern psychology to understand evil in a new way. But as soon as I started my research, I found out I was too late. By 1 year. A 3,000-year-old question had been given a complete and compelling psychological explanation the previous year by Roy Baumeister, one of today's most creative social psychologists. In Evil, Inside Human Cruelty and Aggression, Baumeister examines evil from the perspective of both victim and perpetrator. When taking the perpetrator's perspective, he found that people who do things we see as evil, from spousal abuse all the way to genocide, rarely think they are doing anything wrong. They almost always see themselves as responding to attacks and provocations in ways that are justified. They often think that they themselves are victims. But of course, you can see right through this tactic. You are good at understanding the biases that others use to protect their self-esteem. The disturbing part is that Baumeister shows us our own distortions as victims and as righteous advocates of victims. Almost everywhere Baumeister looked in the research literature, he found that victims often shared some of the blame. Most murders result from an escalating cycle of provocation and retaliation. Often, the corpse could just as easily have been the murderer. In half of all domestic disputes, both sides used violence. Baumeister points out that, even in instances of obvious police brutality, such as the infamous videotaped beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1991, there is usually much more to the story than is shown on the news. News programs gain viewers by satisfying people's need to believe that evil stalks the land. Baumeister is an extraordinary social psychologist, in part because in his search for truth, he is unconcerned about political correctness. Sometimes evil falls out of a clear blue sky onto the head of an innocent victim, but most cases are much more complicated. And Baumeister is willing to violate the taboo against blaming the victim in order to understand what really happened. People usually have reasons for committing violence, and those reasons usually involve retaliation for perceived injustice or self-defense. This does not mean that both sides are equally to blame. Perpetrators often grossly overreact and misinterpret using self-serving biases. But Baumeister's point is that we have a deep need to understand violence and cruelty through what he calls the myth of pure evil. Of this myth's many parts, the most important are that evildoers are pure in their evil motives. They have no motives for their actions beyond sadism and greed. Victims are pure in their victimhood. They did nothing to bring about their victimization. And evil comes from outside and is associated with a group or force that attacks our group. Furthermore, anyone who questions the application of the myth, who dares muddy the waters of moral certainty, is in league with evil. The myth of pure evil is the ultimate self-serving bias, the ultimate form of naive realism, and it is the ultimate cause of most long-running cycles of violence because both sides use it to lock themselves into a Manichaean struggle. When George W. Bush said that the 9/11 terrorists did what they did because they hate our freedom, he showed a stunning lack of psychological insight. Neither the 9/11 hijackers nor Osama bin Laden were particularly upset because American women can drive, vote, and wear bikinis. Rather, many Islamic extremists want to kill Americans because they are using the myth of pure evil to interpret Arab history and current events. They see America as the great Satan, the current villain in a long pageant of Western humiliation of Arab nations and peoples. They did what they did as a reaction to America's actions and impact in the Middle East, as they see it through the distortions of the myth of pure evil. However horrifying it is for terrorists to lump all civilians into the category of enemy and then kill them indiscriminately, such actions at least make psychological sense, whereas killing because of a hatred for freedom does not. In another unsettling conclusion, Baumeister found that violence and cruelty have four main causes. The first two are obvious attributes of evil, greed, ambition, violence for direct personal gain, as in robbery, and sadism, pleasure in hurting people. But greed, ambition, explains only a small portion of violence, and sadism explains almost none. Outside of children's cartoons and horror films, people almost never hurt others for the sheer joy of hurting someone. The two biggest causes of evil are two that we think are good, and that we try to encourage in our children: high self-esteem and moral idealism. Having high self-esteem doesn't directly cause violence, but when someone's high esteem is unrealistic or narcissistic, it is easily threatened by reality. In reaction to those threats, people, particularly young men, often lash out violently. Baumeister questions the usefulness of programs that try to raise children's self-esteem directly instead of by teaching them skills they can be proud of. Such direct enhancement can potentially foster unstable narcissism. Threatened self-esteem accounts for a large portion of violence at the individual level, but to really get a mass atrocity going, you need idealism, the belief that your violence is a means to a moral end. The major atrocities of the 20th century were carried out largely either by men who thought they were creating a utopia, or else by men who believed they were defending their homeland or tribe from attack. Idealism easily becomes dangerous because it brings with it, almost inevitably, the belief that the ends justify the means. If you are fighting for good or for God, what matters is the outcome, not the path. People have little respect for rules. We respect the moral principles that underlie most rules. But when a moral mission and legal rules are incompatible, we usually care more about the mission. The psychologist Linda Skitka finds that when people have strong moral feelings about a controversial issue, when they have a moral mandate, they care much less about procedural fairness in court cases. They want the good guys freed by any means and the bad guys convicted by any means. It is thus not surprising that the administration of George W. Bush consistently argues that extrajudicial killings, indefinite imprisonment without trial, and harsh physical treatment of prisoners are legal and proper steps in fighting the Manichaean War on Terror. Finding the Great Way. In philosophy classes, I often came across the idea that the world is an illusion. I never really knew what that meant, although it sounded deep. But after 2 decades studying moral psychology, I think I finally get it. The anthropologist Clifford Geertz wrote that, "Man is an animal suspended in webs of significance that he himself has spun." That is, the world we live in is not really one made of rocks, trees, and physical objects. It is a world of insults, opportunities, status symbols, betrayals, saints and sinners. All of these are human creations which, though real in their own way, are not real in the way that rocks and trees are real. These human creations are like fairies in J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. They exist only if you believe in them. They are the Matrix from the movie of that name. They are a consensual hallucination. The inner lawyer, the rose-colored mirror, naive realism, and the myth of pure evil. These mechanisms all conspire to weave for us a web of significance upon which angels and demons fight it out. Our ever-judging minds then give us constant flashes of approval and disapproval, along with the certainty that we are on the side of the angels. From this vantage point, it all seems so silly, all this moralism, righteousness, and hypocrisy. It's beyond silly. It is tragic, for it suggests that human beings will never achieve a state of lasting peace and harmony. So what can you do about it? The first step is to see it as a game and stop taking it so seriously. The great lesson that comes out of ancient India is that life as we experience it is a game called samsara. It is a game in which each person plays out his dharma, his role or part in a giant play. In the game of samsara, good things happen to you, and you are happy. Then bad things happen, and you are sad or angry. And so it goes until you die. Then you are reborn back into it, and it repeats. The message of the Bhagavad Gita, a central text of Hinduism, is that you can't quit the game entirely. You have a role to play in the functioning of the universe, and you must play that role. But you should do it in the right way, without being attached to the fruits or outcomes of your action. The god Krishna says, I love the man who hates not nor exults, who mourns not nor desires, who is the same to friend and foe, the same whether he be respected or despised, the same in heat and cold, in pleasure and in pain, who has put away attachment and remains unmoved by praise or blame, contented with whatever comes his way. Buddha went a step further. He too counseled indifference to the ups and downs of life, but he urged that we quit the game entirely. Buddhism is a set of practices for escaping samsara and the endless cycle of rebirth. Though divided on whether to retreat from the world or engage with it, Buddhists all agree on the importance of training the mind to stop its incessant judging. Sen San, an early Chinese Zen master, urged non-judgmentalism as a prerequisite to following the perfect way in this poem from the 8th century CE. The perfect way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Do not like, do not dislike, all will then be clear. Make a hairbreadth difference, and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle between for and against is the mind's worst disease. Judgmentalism is indeed a disease of the mind. It leads to anger, torment, and conflict. But it is also the mind's normal condition. The elephant is always evaluating, always saying, like it or don't like it. So how can you change your automatic reactions? You know by now that you can't simply resolve to stop judging others or to stop being a hypocrite. But, as Buddha taught, the rider can gradually learn to tame the elephant, and meditation is one way to do so. Meditation has been shown to make people calmer, less reactive to the ups and downs and petty provocations of life. Meditation is the Eastern way of training yourself to take things philosophically. Cognitive therapy works too. In Feeling Good, a popular guide to cognitive therapy, David Burns has written a chapter on cognitive therapy for anger. He advises using many of the same techniques that Aaron Beck used for depression. Write down your thoughts, learn to recognize the distortions in your thoughts, and then think of a more appropriate thought. Burns focuses on the should statements we carry around, ideas about how the world should work, and about how people should treat us. Violations of these should statements are the major causes of anger and resentment. Burns also advises empathy. In a conflict, look at the world from your opponent's point of view, and you'll see that she is not entirely crazy. Although I agree with Burns' general approach, the material I have reviewed in this chapter suggests that once anger comes into play, people find it extremely difficult to empathize with and understand another perspective. A better place to start is, as Jesus advised, with yourself and the log in your own eye. Batson and Lowenstein both found that debiasing occurred only when subjects were forced to look at themselves. And you will see the log only if you set out on a deliberate and effortful quest to look for it. Try this now. Think of a recent interpersonal conflict with someone you care about, and then find one way in which your behavior was not exemplary. Maybe you did something insensitive, even if you had a right to do it, or hurtful, even if you meant well, or inconsistent with your principles, even though you can readily justify it. When you first catch sight of a fault in yourself, you'll likely hear frantic arguments from your inner lawyer excusing you and blaming others, but try not to listen. You are on a mission to find at least one thing that you did wrong. When you extract a splinter, it hurts, briefly, but then you feel relief, even pleasure. When you find a fault in yourself, it will hurt, briefly, but if you keep going and acknowledge the fault, you are likely to be rewarded with a flash of pleasure that is mixed, oddly, with a hint of pride. It is the pleasure of taking responsibility for your own behavior. It is the feeling of honor. Finding fault with yourself is also the key to overcoming the hypocrisy and judgmentalism that damage so many valuable relationships. The instant you see some contribution you made to a conflict, your anger softens, maybe just a bit, but enough that you might be able to acknowledge some merit on the other side. You can still believe you are right and the other person is wrong, but if you can move to believing that you are mostly right, and your opponent is mostly wrong, you have the basis for an effective and non-humiliating apology. You can take a small piece of the disagreement and say, "I should not have done X, and I can see why you felt Y." Then, by the power of reciprocity, the other person will likely feel a strong urge to say, "Yes, I was really upset by X, but I guess I shouldn't have done P, so I can see why you felt Q." Reciprocity, amplified by self-serving biases, drove you apart back when you were matching insults or hostile gestures. But you can turn the process around and use reciprocity to end a conflict and save a relationship. The human mind may have been shaped by evolutionary processes to play Machiavellian tit-for-tat, and it seems to come equipped with cognitive processes that predispose us to hypocrisy, self-righteousness, and moralistic conflict. But sometimes, by knowing the mind's structure and strategies, we can step out of the ancient game of social manipulation and enter into a game of our choosing. By seeing the log in our own eye, you can become less biased, less moralistic, and therefore less inclined toward argument and conflict. You can begin to follow the perfect way, the path to happiness that leads through acceptance, which is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 5. The Pursuit of Happiness. Good men at all times surrender in truth all attachments. The holy spend not idle words on things of desire. When pleasure or pain comes to them, the wise feel above pleasure and pain. Buddha. Do not seek to have events happen as you want them to, but instead want them to happen as they do happen, and your life will go well. Epictetus. If money or power could buy happiness, then the author of the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes should have been overjoyed. The text attributes itself to a king in Jerusalem, who looks back on his life and his search for happiness and fulfillment. He tried at one point to make a test of pleasure by seeking happiness in his riches. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and delights of the flesh, and many concubines. So I became great, and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Ecclesiastes, chapter 2, verses 4 through 10. But in what may be one of the earliest reports of a midlife crisis, the author finds it all pointless. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it, and again all was vanity and a chasing after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 11. The author tells us about many other avenues he pursued, hard work, learning, wine, but nothing brought satisfaction. Nothing could banish the feeling that his life had no more intrinsic worth or purpose than that of an animal. From the perspective of Buddha and the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, the author's problem is obvious, his pursuit of happiness. Buddhism and Stoicism teach that striving for external goods, or to make the world conform to your wishes, is always a striving after wind. Happiness can only be found within, by breaking attachments to external things and cultivating an attitude of acceptance. Stoics and Buddhists can have relationships, jobs, and possessions, but to avoid becoming upset upon losing them, they must not be emotionally attached to them. This idea is, of course, an extension of the truth of chapter 2. Life itself is but what you deem it, and your mental state determines how you deem things. But recent research in psychology suggests that Buddha and Epictetus may have taken things too far. Some things are worth striving for, and happiness comes in part from outside of yourself, if you know where to look. The Progress Principle. The author of Ecclesiastes wasn't just battling the fear of meaninglessness. He was battling the disappointment of success. The pleasure of getting what you want is often fleeting. You dream about getting a promotion, being accepted into a prestigious school, or finishing a big project. You work every waking hour, perhaps imagining how happy you'd be if you could just achieve that goal. Then you succeed, and if you're lucky, you get an hour, maybe a day, of euphoria, particularly if your success was unexpected and there was a moment in which it was revealed. The envelope, please. More typically, however, you don't get any euphoria. When success seems increasingly probable and some final event confirms what you already had begun to expect, the feeling is more one of relief, the pleasure of closure and release. In such circumstances, my first thought is seldom, "Hooray, fantastic!" It is, "Okay, what do I have to do now?" My underjoyed response to success turns out to be normal, and from an evolutionary point of view, it's even sensible. Animals get a rush of dopamine, the pleasure neurotransmitter, whenever they do something that advances their evolutionary interests and moves them ahead in the game of life. Food and sex give pleasure. And that pleasure serves as a reinforcer, in behaviorist terms, that motivates later efforts to find food and sex. For humans, however, the game is more complex. People win at the game of life by achieving high status and a good reputation, cultivating friendships, finding the best mates, accumulating resources, and rearing their children to be successful at the same game. People have many goals and therefore many sources of pleasure. So you'd think we would receive an enormous and long-lasting shot of dopamine whenever we succeed at an important goal. But here's the trick with reinforcement. It works best when it comes seconds, not minutes or hours, after the behavior. Just try training your dog to fetch by giving him a big steak 10 minutes after each successful retrieval. It can't be done. The elephant works the same way. It feels pleasure whenever it takes a step in the right direction. The elephant learns whenever pleasure or pain follows immediately after behavior, but it has trouble connecting success on Friday with actions it took on Monday. Richard Davidson, the psychologist who brought us affective style and the approach circuits of the front left cortex, writes about two types of positive effect. The first he calls pre-goal attainment positive effect, which is the pleasurable feeling you get as you make progress toward a goal. The second is called post-goal attainment positive effect, which Davidson says arises once you have achieved something you want. You experience this latter feeling as contentment, as a short-lived feeling of release when the left prefrontal cortex reduces its activity after a goal has been achieved. In other words, when it comes to goal pursuit, it really is the journey that counts, not the destination. Set for yourself any goal you want. Most of the pleasure will be had along the way, with every step that takes you closer. The final moment of success is often no more thrilling than the relief of taking off a heavy backpack at the end of a long hike. If you went on the hike only to feel that pleasure, you are a fool. Yet people sometimes do just this. They work hard at a task and expect some special euphoria at the end. But when they achieve success and find only moderate and short-lived pleasure, they ask, as the singer Peggy Lee once did, "Is that all there is?" They devalue their accomplishments as a striving after wind. We can call this the progress principle. Pleasure comes from making progress toward goals than from achieving them. Shakespeare captured it perfectly. Things won are done. Joy's soul lies in the doing. The adaptation principle. If I gave you 10 seconds to name the very best and very worst things that could ever happen to you, you might well come up with these: winning a $20 million lottery jackpot and becoming paralyzed from the neck down. Winning the lottery would bring freedom from so many cares and limitations. It would enable you to pursue your dreams, help others, and live in comfort, so it ought to bring long-lasting happiness rather than one serving of dopamine. Losing the use of your body, on the other hand, would bring more limitations than life in prison. You'd have to give up on nearly all your goals and dreams, forget about sex, and depend on other people for help with eating and bathroom functions. Many people think they would rather be dead than paraplegic, but they are mistaken. Of course, it's better to win the lottery than to break your neck, but not by as much as you'd think. Because whatever happens, you're likely to adapt to it, but you don't realize up front that you will. We are bad at effective forecasting, that is, predicting how we'll feel in the future. We grossly overestimate the intensity and the duration of our emotional reactions. Within a year, lottery winners and paraplegics have both, on average, returned most of the way to their baseline levels of happiness. The lottery winner buys a new house and a new car, quits her boring job, and eats better food. She gets a kick out of the contrast with her former life, but within a few months, the contrast blurs and the pleasure fades. The human mind is extraordinarily sensitive to changes in conditions, but not so sensitive to absolute levels. The winner's pleasure comes from rising in wealth, not from standing still at a high level. And after a few months, the new comforts have become the new baseline of daily life. The winner takes them for granted and has no way to rise any further. Even worse, the money might damage her relationships. Friends, relatives, swindlers, and sobbing strangers swarm around lottery winners, suing them, sucking up to them, demanding a share of the wealth. Remember the ubiquity of self-serving biases. Everyone can find a reason to be owed something. Lottery winners are so often harassed that many have to move, hide, end relationships, and finally turn to each other, forming lottery winner support groups to deal with their new difficulties. It should be noted, however, that nearly all lottery winners are still glad that they won. At the other extreme, the quadriplegic takes a huge happiness loss up front. He thinks his life is over, and it hurts to give up everything he once hoped for. But like the lottery winner, his mind is sensitive more to changes than to absolute levels, so after a few months, he has begun adapting to his new situation and is setting more modest goals. He discovers that physical therapy can expand his abilities. He has nowhere to go but up, and each step gives him the pleasure of the progress principle. The physicist Stephen Hawking has been trapped in a shell of a body since his early 20s, when he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease. Yet he went on to solve major problems in cosmology, win many prizes, and write the best-selling science book of all time. During a recent interview in the New York Times, he was asked how he keeps his spirits up. He replied, "My expectations were reduced to zero when I was 21. Everything since then has been a bonus." This is the adaptation principle at work. People's judgments about their present state are based on whether it is better or worse than the state to which they have become accustomed. Adaptation is, in part, just a property of neurons. Nerve cells respond vigorously to new stimuli, but gradually they habituate, firing less to stimuli than they have become used to. It is change that contains vital information, not steady states. Human beings, however, take adaptation to cognitive extremes. We don't just habituate, we recalibrate. We create for ourselves a world of targets, and each time we hit one, we replace it with another. After a string of successes, we aim higher. After a massive setback, such as a broken neck, we aim lower. Instead of following Buddhist and Stoic advice to surrender attachments and let events happen, we surround ourselves with goals, hopes, and expectations, and then feel pleasure and pain in relation to our progress. When we combine the adaptation principle with the discovery that people's average level of happiness is highly heritable, we come to a startling possibility. In the long run, it doesn't much matter what happens to you. Good fortune or bad, you will always return to your happiness set point, your brain's default level of happiness, which was determined largely by your genes. In 1759, long before anyone knew about genes, Adam Smith reached the same conclusion. In every permanent situation, where there is no expectation of change, the mind of every man, in a longer or shorter time, returns to its natural and usual state of tranquility. In prosperity, after a certain time, it falls back to that state. In adversity, after a certain time, it rises up to it. If this idea is correct, then we are all stuck on what has been called the hedonic treadmill. On an exercise treadmill, you can increase the speed all you want, but you stay in the same place. In life, you can work as hard as you want and accumulate all the riches, fruit trees, and concubines you want, but you can't get ahead. Because you can't change your natural and usual state of tranquility, the riches you accumulate will just raise your expectations and leave you no better off than you were before. Yet, not realizing the futility of our efforts, we continue to strive, all the while doing things that help us win at the game of life. Always wanting more than we have, we run and run and run, like hamsters on a wheel. An early happiness hypothesis. Buddha, Epictetus, and many other sages saw the futility of the rat race and urged people to quit. They proposed a particular happiness hypothesis. Happiness comes from within, and it cannot be found by making the world conform to your desires. Buddhism teaches that attachment leads inevitably to suffering and offers tools for breaking attachments. The Stoic philosophers of ancient Greece, such as Epictetus, taught their followers to focus only on what they could fully control, which meant primarily their own thoughts and reactions. All other events, the gifts and curses of fortune, were externals, and the true Stoic was unaffected by externals. Neither Buddha nor the Stoics urged people to withdraw into a cave. In fact, both doctrines have such enduring appeal precisely because they offer guidance on how to find peace and happiness while participating in a treacherous and ever-changing social world. Both doctrines are based on an empirical claim, a happiness hypothesis that asserts that striving to obtain goods and goals in the external world cannot bring you more than momentary happiness. You must work on your internal world. If the hypothesis is true, it has profound implications for how we should live our lives, raise our children, and spend our money. But is it true? It all depends on what kind of externals we are talking about. The second biggest finding in happiness research, after the strong influence of genes upon a person's average level of happiness, is that most environmental and demographic factors influence happiness very little. Try to imagine yourself changing places with either Bob or Mary. Bob is 35 years old, single, white, attractive, and athletic. He earns $100,000 a year and lives in sunny Southern California. He is highly intellectual, and he spends his free time reading and going to museums. Mary and her husband live in snowy Buffalo, New York, where they earn a combined income of $40,000. Mary is 65 years old, black, overweight, and plain in appearance. She is highly sociable, and she spends her free time mostly in activities related to her church. She is on dialysis for kidney problems. Bob seems to have it all, and few readers of this book would prefer Mary's life to his. Yet, if you had to bet on it, you should bet that Mary is happier than Bob. What Mary has that Bob lacks are strong connections. A good marriage is one of the life factors most strongly and consistently associated with happiness. Part of this apparent benefit comes from reverse correlation. Happiness causes marriage. Happy people marry sooner and stay married longer than people with a lower happiness set point, both because they are more appealing as dating partners and because they are easier to live with as spouses. But much of the apparent benefit is a real and lasting benefit of dependable companionship, which is a basic need. We never fully adapt either to it or to its absence. Mary also has religion, and religious people are happier, on average, than non-religious people. This effect arises from the social ties that come with participation in a religious community, as well as from feeling connected to something beyond the self. What Bob has going for him is a string of objective advantages in power, status, freedom, health, and sunshine, all of which are subject to the adaptation principle. White Americans are freed from many of the hassles and indignities that affect Black Americans, yet on average, they are only very slightly happier. Men have more freedom and power than women, yet they are not on average any happier. Women experience more depression, but also more intense joy. The young have so much more to look forward to than the elderly, yet ratings of life satisfaction actually rise slightly with age, up to age 65, and in some studies, well beyond. People are often surprised to hear that the old are happier than the young because the old have so many more health problems. Yet people adapt to most chronic health problems, such as Mary's, although ailments that grow progressively worse do reduce well-being, and a recent study finds that adaptation to disability is not, on average, complete. People who live in cold climates expect people who live in California to be happier, but they are wrong. People believe that attractive people are happier than unattractive people, but they too are wrong. The one thing Bob does have going for him is wealth. But here the story is complicated. The most widely reported conclusion from surveys done by psychologist Ed Diener is that within any given country, at the lowest end of the income scale, money does buy happiness. People who worry every day about paying for food and shelter report significantly less well-being than those who don't. But once you are freed from basic needs and have entered the middle class, the relationship between wealth and happiness becomes smaller. The rich are happier on average than the middle class, but only by a little. And part of this relationship is reverse correlation. Happy people grow rich faster because, as in the marriage market, they are more appealing to others, such as bosses, and also because their frequent positive emotions help them to commit to projects, to work hard, and to invest in their futures. Wealth itself has only a small direct effect on happiness because it so effectively speeds up the hedonic treadmill. For example, as the level of wealth has doubled or tripled in the last 50 years in many industrialized nations, the levels of happiness and satisfaction with life that people report have not changed, and depression has actually become more common. Vast increases in gross domestic product led to improvements in the comforts of life. A larger home, more cars, televisions, and restaurant meals, better health, and longer life. But these improvements became the normal conditions of life. All were adapted to and taken for granted, so they did not make people feel any happier or more satisfied. These findings would have pleased Buddha and Epictetus, if, that is, they found pleasure in such external events as being proved right. As in their day, people today devote themselves to the pursuit of goals that won't make them happier, in the process neglecting the sort of inner growth and spiritual development that could bring lasting satisfaction. One of the most consistent lessons the ancient sages teach is to let go, stop striving, and choose a new path. Turn inwards, or toward God, but for God's sake, stop trying to make the world conform to your will. The Bhagavad Gita is a Hindu treatise on non-attachment. In a section on human devils, The god Krishna describes humanity's lower nature and the people who give in to it. Bound by hundreds of fetters forged by hope, obsessed by anger and desire, they seek to build up wealth unjustly to satisfy their lusts. Krishna then parodies the thinking of such a devil. This have I gained today, this whim I'll satisfy. This wealth is mine, and much more too will be mine as time goes on. He was an enemy of mine. I've killed him, and many other too I'll kill. I'm master here. I take my pleasure as I will. I'm strong and happy and successful. Substitute defeat for kill, and you have a pretty good description of the modern Western ideal, at least in some corners of the business world. So even if Bob were just as happy as Mary, if he has an arrogant, entitled attitude and treats people badly, his life would still be spiritually and aesthetically worse. The Happiness Formula. In the 1990s, the two big findings of happiness research, strong relation to genes, weak relation to environment, hit the psychological community hard because they applied not just to happiness, but to most aspects of personality. Psychologists since Freud had shared a nearly religious devotion to the idea that personality is shaped primarily by childhood environment. This axiom was taken on faith. The evidence for it consisted almost entirely of correlations, usually small ones, between what parents did and how their children turned out, and anyone who suggested that these correlations were caused by genes was dismissed as a reductionist. But as twin studies revealed the awesome reach of genes and the relative unimportance of the family environment that siblings share, the ancient happiness hypothesis grew ever more plausible. Maybe there really is a set point, fixed into every brain, like a thermostat set forever to 58 degrees Fahrenheit for depressives, or 75 degrees for happy people. Maybe the only way to find happiness, therefore, is to change one's own internal setting, for example, through meditation, Prozac, or cognitive therapy, instead of changing one's environment. As psychologists wrestled with these ideas, however, and as biologists worked out the first sketch of the human genome, a more sophisticated understanding of nature and nurture began to emerge. Yes, genes explain far more about us than anyone had realized, but the genes themselves often turn out to be sensitive to environmental conditions. And yes, each person has a characteristic level of happiness, but it now looks as though it's not so much a set point as a potential range or probability distribution. Whether you operate on the high or the low side of your potential range is determined by many factors that Buddha and Epictetus would have considered externals. When Martin Seligman founded positive psychology in the late 1990s, one of his first moves was to bring together small groups of experts to tackle specific problems. One group was created to study the externals that matter for happiness. Three psychologists, Sonia Lyubomirsky, Ken Sheldon, and David Skade, reviewed the available evidence and realized that there are two fundamentally different kinds of externals, the conditions of your life and the voluntary activities that you undertake. Conditions include facts about your life that you can't change, race, sex, age, disability, as well as things you can, wealth, marital status, where you live. Conditions are constant over time, at least during a period in your life, and so they are the sorts of things that you are likely to adapt to. Voluntary activities, on the other hand, are the things that you choose to do, such as meditation, exercise, learning a new skill, or taking a vacation. Because such activities must be chosen, and because most of them take effort and attention, they can't just disappear from your awareness the way conditions can. Voluntary activities, therefore, offer much greater promise for increasing happiness while avoiding adaptation effects. One of the most important ideas in positive psychology is what Lyubomirsky, Sheldon, Skade, and Seligman call the happiness formula. H equals S plus C plus V. The level of happiness that you actually experience, H, is determined by your biological set point, S, plus the conditions of your life, C, plus plus the voluntary activities, V, you do. The challenge for positive psychology is to use the scientific method to find out exactly what kinds of C and V can push H up to the top of your potential range. The extreme biological version of the happiness hypothesis says